a while last night and listened to the broadcast on WFMU from 1978 or whenever you first came to America. I don't have any plans on using anything from that tape, but it was rather strange, not the music that you played, but the way the gentleman that was in the studio with you went about talking to you. Do you have anything to say about that? Because that was, I think, quite
comment on something that happened 10 years ago and imagining that I'm going to remember it.
Oh, okay. It just seemed quite unorthodox to me.
You're probably talking about Dan Behrman,
mm-hmm.
who was an unorthodox fellow. I don't know whether I think he's still around.
Okay. I don't know much about the recording, The Technology of Tears, other than it was released not too long ago, and on the back of it, it mentions that it was written for dance companies.
Yes.
Could you tell me a little bit about how you composed it and how you performed it in the studio and about why you got commissioned to do music for dance companies?
Well, the reason I got commissioned was because the choreographer in question, Rosalind Newman, had previously choreographed some things of mine that were on record, and she liked the idea of doing something a bit more challenging than just taking something that already existed. So she asked me to write something specifically for her. And the process of recording the piece was quite a long and complicated one, partly because it was an ambitious piece of work. It was a 40-minute long piece of music, which is quite long. And second, because the process of working with a choreographer on a piece of music is quite different from working with other musicians. Choreographers have different concerns, and I had to adjust quite a lot to what she needed for the dancing and so on without compromising what I wanted in terms of the music. And sometimes I found it hard, especially at the beginning when I kind of assumed that she would just accept whatever I gave her, and then when she didn't, I realized that I would have to redo things. I had to really adjust my mindset quite a lot. But in the end, I really appreciated the fact that she put so much input into it, because it really changed my idea about how I can write music. I mean, she really had to force me to do certain things, and I ended up doing a lot of editing, which was an interesting process. In fact, one of the pieces, Jigsaw, was a reaction to doing Technology of Tears, in as much as I did so much editing in the first part of Technology of Tears that I decided with Jigsaw that I would write music which was automatically editable. Everything on Jigsaw was recorded in fragments of about 15 seconds long, and they were all interchangeable, so I could edit from one section to another when we were mixing and try out different things without having to dismantle pieces of music which weren't designed to have that done to them. It was quite an elaborate process.
Okay, thank you. Are you going to be doing more of the studio type of music in the future? I noticed trying to get hold of you the last couple months, you've been on the road a lot. What kind of things are you doing right now?
Well, I wasn't on the road, actually. I was one of the times when you were trying to reach me, I was working on a film soundtrack in Montreal for about 2 months, which is not exactly on the road. I've been doing this film soundtrack. That's one of the things I've been doing lately for a film called The Top of His Head. It's a Canadian feature film that'll be released in the spring. And other than that, I've been concentrating also on working in other people's projects, which is, for me, a kind of a way to rest from work as a composer, which I needed after doing Technology of Tears. I needed to regroup and think a little bit about what I wanted to do next, especially since I don't have a band at the moment, because Skeleton Crew is defunct. So I've been working as a bass player with John Zorn and his group Naked City, and I've been working with a German composer called Heiner Goebbels, who you may know through his work with a group called Cassiber. But then again, maybe you don't. And that was a group that we've just been touring Europe with, Arthur Lindsay, and he and I, and some musicians from East Germany, Johannes Bauer and Dieter Diesner.
Okay, thanks. That you mentioned John Zorn, and there was another question I wanted to ask you. The Technology of Tears mentions that John Zorn and Christian Marclay play. What role did they have in the composition or the improvisation? I don't know how it came together.
Well, they didn't have any specific role as composers, although what they contributed is very important to the final feeling of the composition. I was concerned, especially in Technology of Tears, with the relationship between technology, music technology, and people, and the way that people play. And a lot of the music, and especially in the first part, is made by machines and computers. And I like to juxtapose that with the most passionate sounding human instruments possible. And so Tenko's voice and John's saxophone fill the role of being kind of like human voices against the technology, in a way. Christian's role was a little bit different because he was integrating his records in a more structural sense, not so much concerned with passion, more concerned with placing idioms in a certain way across the spectrum of a piece of music.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to backtrack for a minute now in your career and talk about Massacre for a moment. Massacre seems to be a guitar power trio, while your other work up to that time had been with different types of ensembles, exploring new ground as a soloist or doing not so much abrasive music. How did you approach your role in Massacre differently than you did in those other settings, such as Henry Cow or Skeleton Crew, both as a composer and as an improvising performer?
You should bear in mind that you just made an anachronistic statement, since Massacre predated Skeleton Crew by quite a long way. However, bearing that in mind, Massacre was very much a reaction to my first arrival in New York. Fred Meyer and Bill Laswell were the first two musicians that I met when I first arrived in New York in 1978, and it was very logical that we would work together. They were, in fact, the first time I met them, performing Art Bears material, among other things. So they had a certain knowledge of my past, and I really liked the fact that they had no kind of European sensibility, which is where I was coming from, and that they therefore would push me in a new direction, and Massacre was a new direction, which depended very much in a way on their energy. Although I wrote the outlines of music, the basic feeling of Massacre was always improvised. I would provide a structure which we would then launch away from.
Were different performance techniques found for Massacre that you hadn't used at any other time in any of your other work?
When you're talking in a way as to suggest a degree of consciousness which maybe wasn't always there and maybe isn't always there when I'm working. Because Massacre was largely improvised, I wasn't particularly focusing on this or that technique. It was more a question of intuition and trying to find a different kind of energy in music. So I don't know whether I can answer the question in any intelligent way based on the way that you couched it.
Okay. I've read some reviews by critics who use labels to try to describe how they feel about the music, and whether or not I agree with it, Massacre has been described in various magazines as psychedelic punk and as a marriage of avant-garde brains with new wave boldness. What did you hope to accomplish when you begun the collaboration, and how do you feel about the results and the subsequent critique?
I never care about what critics say, because, I mean, that's perhaps a slight exaggeration. Sometimes I find it mildly irritating. Sometimes, of course, I like to read people say nice things about me, like anybody else. But in the end, these labels are not particularly useful to me, and not necessarily particularly useful to anybody else either. Journalists are obsessed by labels because they feel as if it's the best way to communicate what's going on, but I have come to question whether that's particularly valid. I mean, it's like labeling what I did in the 70s progressive or what I'm doing now as art rock. I mean, what does that tell anybody? It doesn't tell me very much. As far as what I was trying to do in Massacre, it has... I'm speechless. The goals that you have when you set out working with other musicians are not related in media terms at all. You're not thinking about what the media are going to say to you. My aim with Massacre at the time was to enjoy myself, which is always an aim when I'm playing music, and to explore the idea of playing loud music, which is something that I hadn't done in a long time, not since I first started playing in rock bands in the 60s. Although Henry Cow was sometimes loud, it wasn't loud in that way. And to do something which was extremely simple, because I felt as if very often with Henry Cow things became needlessly complicated, almost complicated for its own sake. And sometimes we got past that, but sometimes I was frustrated by the fact that we were always tending to put a bar of 7/8 in when a bar of 4/4 would have done. And Massacre was a way to try and make good new music which had rock energy and which was not in any way complex, which was used simplicity as something which was a positive asset without being simplistic.
Okay, now I'd like to move on and talk about some of your solo guitar work. And just for the sake of my listening audience, which may not be familiar with any of your work, as you and I are, could you describe some of the approaches and techniques that you've pioneered as a guitar soloist?
Where is your radio station located?
It's in Bowling Green, Ohio.
Uh-huh.
The hub of the Midwest. You have pioneered, you know, new guitar techniques, prepared guitar, use of found objects, and I've seen photographs of your homemade instruments, which look quite interesting. And could you just tell me a little bit about some of these things?
If you've seen the pictures, you could probably do just as good a job yourself. The homemade instruments are basically planks of wood with strings across them. They were designed to be as flexible as possible from the point of view of the changes that I can make. The pickups are movable, they have frets which are removable, they can be battered around without any serious problem of demolition. The reason I made the homemade instruments was because in concert as a soloist I had begun years before laying guitars out flat on the table and treating them more as sound sources than as guitars, and as I went through the process of doing that, I came to the realization that the instruments as guitars were virtually irrelevant. I mean, I wasn't using them as guitars, they were just strings, amplified strings, and if I was going to make something with amplified strings, I might just as well use a plank of wood as go to the expense of having a beautiful guitar and then beating it up. As far as the preparation is concerned, it would be pretty silly to give one example, because I did just about everything imaginable to the poor little dears.
Okay, thanks. A 1983 Downbeat article discussed some of your early influences, such as John Cage and Frank Zappa. Could you explain how you developed your unique approach to the instrument and how these influences have affected your music up to now?
I developed my approach to the instrument, like everybody else does, through the application of logic. These things just go along. You play the guitar, you hear something that you don't understand, and you try to understand it, and you get on top of that, and then something else crops up, and you keep working at it. And in the first instance, in my case, I was very interested in the note, for example, that is generated to the left of the left hand if you're a right-handed guitar player, a note that is not amplified because there's no body to resonate, but which you can amplify if you put a pickup on the wrong end of the guitar, which I did. Back in 1970, which is already almost 20 years ago. Most of my guitars from that time on have had a pickup mounted on the nut end of the guitar, and I use a tapping technique which can therefore amplify the left-hand side notes and the right-hand side notes simultaneously, and I use two volume pedals to control how much of each of those notes I want to be heard at any one time. The process of developing the tapping technique, developing the volume pedal technique, developing the preparations, developing the use of these extra notes and scales that are on the left-hand side of the left hand is a process that is still going on now, and which has, you know, been slowly developing over the course of that last 20-year period. And as far as my influences are concerned, which two people did you cite there? Zappa and who?
Zappa and Cage were mentioned in a Downbeat article, although Wayne had mentioned to me that you had never mentioned them to him in the past and had mentioned other people.
Well, I'm sure I would mention other people to somebody else, too. I mean, influence is a strange thing. I mean, in terms of my actual physical playing, I was probably more influenced by listening to people like Snook Zieglin or Mississippi John Hurt in the 60s than by people doing experimental music or more advanced forms later. Zappa certainly had an influence on the earliest manifestation of Henry Cow, along with the Soft Machine. John Cage was an influence mostly in, as many other people have told me, a similar experience, mostly from the point of view of reading what he wrote rather than listening to what he did. Because when I was at college, there wasn't so much of his stuff on record anyway, but his books were available. And his books were very interesting and really changed the way that I thought about music, because they put an emphasis on sound that I hadn't thought of before, which made me want to explore the properties of sound and the way that accidents happen very much. And I still find that that's an important part of my work. But, I mean, you know, I could talk about Bulgarian singers or, you know, countless different possible things that have influenced me. Bulgarian music was a big influence on the Out Bears, for example. What else?
Okay, well, I understand. Thank you very much. I also read Silence over the past summer.
Oh, yeah.
And it changed my approach to music also.
There you go.
No, that was an incredible book. The Downbeat article also mentions Rock in Opposition, which was a union of similar thinking groups from Europe that took a stance against the politics of the music business in order to gain acceptance for their music. Could you explain the politics behind the formation of this collective, what the group stood for, and how Henry Cow fit into the scene, and what the results have been?
Yes. Rock in Opposition was a curious phenomenon which directly resulted from the effects of what I can only describe, excuse my over-politicized language, as the results of imperialism. There exists in the world today a form of musical imperialism coming from the Americans and the British. And since I'm a British person living in America, I'm fairly well aware of the way that it works. But Henry Cow were in the curious position of not being particularly accepted in our own country, so we used to tour in Europe. And when we first started to tour in Europe, as a result of signing with Virgin Records in 1973, we became aware of precisely what this kind of music cultural imperialism actually does in these other countries where the languages are different. For example, we became aware of the phenomenon that if you're a French or a German singer, or come to that, a Brazilian, in some senses, although in Brazil the culture is now very much stronger. In all of these countries there exists a very strong local culture, but it tends to be pushed back by the enormous power of American and English record companies, English since the Beatles, for example, which more or less force young musicians in different countries to conform to modes of expression which have got much more to do with American culture than anything else, and to push back their own culture. And we started to meet French-speaking and Swedish-speaking and Italian-speaking musicians who were really fed up with that situation, who were playing a music which was very inventive, very much a part of their own culture and life, and which had no possibility to be heard in their own countries. They would be sitting there playing this fantastic music, great musicians, and the record companies would not be interested in them. The audiences would assume that because they were not singing in English and didn't sound American, that they couldn't therefore be very interesting. And it seemed to us to be a very strange position. And since we were in the rather odd position of being an English group who were only able to tour in Europe because we were signed to an English record company, and therefore we could do whatever we wanted, and these other groups who were just as good as we were not in that same position of power, we decided to get together with them and try to form a loose kind of collective group which would help them to, just on a simple level, to get gigs. That was the limit of the politics in the end. It was really simply a matter of self-help. We put on festivals in different parts of Europe and invited groups from different countries to come and participate, and the different groups would set up festivals in their own country and invite us to participate, and that's really how it worked. And of course it started a certain kind of communication also between musicians from different countries who would be trying to find out more about each other's work. And in a way it was related to the kind of networking that started to happen in the States as a result of OP magazine in the early 80s, and which has subsequently burgeoned into the late versions, the more commercialized versions like Option and so on, which are also basically helping lesser known musicians find out about each other. And Rock in Opposition was a precursor of all that in Europe.
Okay, thank you. Now I'd like to ask you about several albums and groups that you've been in. I'd like to start with Art Bears. I know that Art Bears splintered off of Henry Cow and was, according to some other people, virtually the same band. How would you describe the music of Art Bears as it applies to the music of Henry Cow and as it is on its own?
To say that it was virtually the same band is completely absurd. The way that it came about, in fact, was precisely because of a disagreement in Henry Cow. The last Art Bears record, the first Art Bears record, was originally intended to be a Henry Cow record.
So Henry Carr came into the studio to make a record, and we had decided to make a record of songs, which is something we'd never done before. And nobody in the group could agree about the quality of what we'd done, and half the group didn't want to release it. And Chris and Dagmar and I, who were the ones who had had the most compositional input into doing the songs, decided that we would release the record ourselves separately and record a few extra things to fill it out, and that Henry Carr would record a later album of other material, which is what subsequently happened. The Western Culture was the result of the later Henry Carr recording sessions, and the first Outbears record was this kind of hybrid ex-Henry Carr record. But the Outbears never existed as a group. In the way that Henry Carr did. Henry Carr was a touring band that was full-time. We were always on the road or recording or rehearsing or doing something together. The Outbears was simply a recording project. We only made one very short tour at the very beginning and then realized that it was not what we wanted to do. We made three albums. Each of these albums, we were only together for the two-week period when we produced the album. we were concentrating exclusively on song form, which is something that Henry Carr never did. And the way the music was recorded was completely different. For example, the way the Outbears worked was that Chris Cutler wrote the lyrics. I would then write the music and all the parts and so forth. We would go into the studio. I would record all the instruments and parts except for the drums. And then Dagmar and Chris would put their stuff on last, usually. So my input as a musician was far greater in a way than it was with Henry Carr, particularly the last versions of Henry Carr. And also Outbears still theoretically exists. It's not impossible that we might not do another record. It's just, you know, a question of time and having the right words and the right music. It's not something that ever died officially.
Okay, thanks. The next album I'd like to talk about is one called Gravity. Could you explain the making of the music behind the album Gravity? There seems to be a lot of cross-cultural music happening here.
Yeah, I was as a result of working on the Outbears, I had become very interested in what is now, I suppose, referred to as world music, although in those days it didn't have a title of that kind. And I had always been very interested in particular in music from the Balkan region of Europe, as a result of the fact that I was at school with a Yugoslavian friend who taught me a lot of folk songs from that region. And I decided that Chris Cutler wrote a song called The Dance, and while I was working on the song, I realized how limited Western people's idea of dance music is, as particularly as it refers to disco music, and that most people had made a habit, for example, of referring to Henry Carr as a definition, as music you can't dance to. And it seemed to me to be quite funny, the enormous variety of dance music that there is in the world, and how varied the meters are that people dance to and the feelings that people dance to. And this limited idea that Western people had about what constitutes dance music, I thought was kind of ridiculous, and I thought it would be funny to make a record where I would research dance music from all over the world and then kind of mix it all up together in some kind of personal way and make a record of kind of a new kind of dance music, which was based on listening to world dance music and which would have nothing to do with disco at all. And that's what I did.
Okay, thank you. The next album I'd like to talk about is Cheap at Half the Price. On that album, side one seems to be structured as pop songs, and side two seems to have a more complex sort of exploration of new sounds and a little bit of a different kind of compositional structure. How was the music on this album created, and in what other aspects are the two sides different from each other or similar to each other?
That record was made at home on a four-track tape recorder, and it was a kind of an attempt for me to go back to roots that I never actually had. The first record I ever made with Henry Carr was on a 16-track, very sophisticated, in an expensive recording studio. I never went through the process that people go through of, first of all, messing about at home on tape recorders, and I felt as if it was something that I'd missed out on. So I thought it'd be funny to go back now, after making so many records, and do something very primitive at home. The reason the songs came out that way is just one of those things. I mean, I didn't record them separately. They were all recorded around the same time, and that just seemed to be the best order that they fit into. I might have mixed them up differently, you know, and had songs on both sides, but in the end it seemed that worked better, which is a pragmatic reason for making song orders anyway. It's the way mostly it's done. I used a lot of different kinds of techniques. A lot of the drum stuff came from the Gravity sessions, when I'd asked one of the drummers to make short examples of all the different kinds of music that he could think of as a drummer. And he would play like 8 bars of funk and 8 bars of this and 8 bars of that, and I had it all on tape. So I kind of made it into loops and edited it around and made it into whole drum tracks, and then started writing the songs around the completed drum track, for example. There are a lot of different things that I did on that record.
Okay. Before I get to that, the album Speechless, it's Massacre material on it, and the other side seemed to be composed in the studio by yourself. What all went into that record, and how does it fit in with some of the other solo records?
It comes in between Gravity and Cheap It Off the Price, incidentally. It was a continuing exploration of what I saw as more popular music forms, which is what the series Gravity, Speechless and Cheap It Off the Price is about. In Speechless, I'm concerned with problems of the voice, people not having a voice, people speaking and other people not listening to them. So there's a certain amount of political material that works its way in there. There's recordings of people demonstrating on Wall Street, in particular an exchange between a demonstrator who's haranguing a policeman who's about to take her away, and he's not listening to what she's saying, and just it repeats over and over again. I found that kind of thing interesting. There's also some accidents that happened that are interesting. There was an interview that I did, and when they played the tape after the interview, something strange had happened to my voice on the tape, which had completely made it unintelligible. It had somehow half-reversed itself, so that you couldn't hear actually any of the words that I was saying, although you could hear that somebody was talking. And that got used as a vocal track on the record. There's a lot of
tape editing procedure.
In fact, the first side wasn't all written in the studio, it was written in advance, and Etron Fou, the group from France who helped me make it, had already rehearsed some of it before I entered the studio, and we then developed it from there after we went in there. And the Massacre material is from a live concert at CBGB, but it's substantially altered in the process of recording.
Thank you. The last album I'd like to ask you about is, how did the collaboration of French, Frith, Kaiser, and Thompson on last year's Live, Love, Larf, and Loaf come about?
It came about largely because Henry Kaiser wanted it to come about, and he badgered us for 2 years until it did come about. He and I have worked together quite a lot over the years, and he and I were both big fans of Richard Thompson from way back. I mean, Henry Cow opened for the Fairport Convention in 1969, for example, so, I mean, I've been aware of Richard's playing for a long time. And Henry gave Richard some albums of ours, and he liked them and said he'd like to work on the record, and it was just a question of nailing down a time when we could all do it, because we were all very busy. And Henry was the one who put all the work into making sure that the idea wouldn't just go away because everyone was too busy, and he kept on at everybody until we all got to the same place at the same time, and we had a lot of fun.
Okay, thank you. I've noticed in the background while I've been talking to you that you're listening to some interesting music. And I'd kind of like to know what that is, because it sounds real nice to me. And the other question I have is, what is going on in today's music scene that you feel is worth attention?
What's going on in the background here is a new CD of Snake Finger, which I just acquired when I was in Europe, so I was listening to it.
Is it a new CD, or is it a re-release of old material?
It's old material, but
okay.
It's all in the CD.
Yeah, because if I'm not mistaken, I believe he passed away, did he not?
Yes.
Okay.
As far as new things that are worth listening to, there's a hell of a lot, of course. There always is. Where to begin? I mean, one place to begin.
If anybody's free this weekend, we'll be going to Victoriaville in the province of Quebec, which is about halfway between
Montreal and Quebec City, where they have the best music festival in North America every October. And you can hear all kinds of stuff from Europe and Canada and US, and in this case Japan also, all gathered together in one place for about 5 days, starting tomorrow.
And who have they got this year?
There's Anthony Braxton's group, there's Tom Cora and a bunch of people from Switzerland in a band called Nemo, there's the Orthotonics, and...
drums on. Band's playing Bill Frisell's band, Wayne Horowitz's band, I think Butch Morris. Those are some of the things that I like at the moment.
That sounds like a heavy festival. In case you're interested, Bowling Green's University does have a music festival every year.
Oh, yeah?
And this year the featured composer is George Crumb.
Oh, yeah.
Morton Subotnick was here last year. John Cage was here the year before. And it sticks pretty much to the academics, and anyone who really isn't affiliated with the university generally is not invited, but it's quite a nice festival.
Uh-huh.
The last question I have for you is, what would it take to, both financially or anything else, to bring you or you and your whatever band you may be with to perform at a university like ours in the Midwest?
Well, it would take a phone call, and then it would take finding out if I'm available in the time when you're interested in doing it, and then it would take figuring out how much you were going to pay me.
It's not very difficult.
Okay, well, the reason I ask is because some other students and I are interested in putting on some concerts around here, both of a local new music bands and of some top performers. I was talking to Sonny Sherrock and Ronald Shannon Jackson because we were interested in bringing Last Exit in.
Uh-huh.
And I just wondered, you know, I don't know when we would put something like this on. It's a little late to do it by the time the festival comes about, which will happen in about 3 weeks, because George Crumb will be here then.
Yeah.
But sometime in the future, we'd like to put something like that together, and the problems we have to think of are getting money to sponsor the event and things like that.
Well, you have to start from your end first. You have to know when it's going to be, and then you have to propose a date to me.
Okay.
And then we go from there.
Yeah, I think some of the students here would probably like to hear you speak or talk about some of the music in seminar also.
Well,
so I could get back with you. I might be interested in doing something along those lines.
Yeah, I do workshops and other things.
Okay. All right, well, thank you very much for the interview. Is there anything you'd like to add that you feel is relevant that I have not addressed?
Well, all I can say is anybody who manages to nominate Bush and Dukakis as the presidential candidates deserves anything they get.
Okay. I guess that's very relevant to today.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
We quite enjoy your music, and this thing will be broadcast on a Sunday night in about 2 weeks. One other thing I'd like to ask is, can I have a mailing address if you'd be interested in hearing a cassette of the show after I put music in it?
Okay. It's P.O. Box 2513.
Okay.
New York, 10009.
All right, I think you would be interested in hearing the program when it's done.
Sure, why not?
Wayne had mentioned he had some cassettes of some material that you gave him, and I would like to ask you if you would mind if I used the thing he has that I'm interested in is the Kitchen Concerts from 1978.
Oh, that one, yeah.
Would you be opposed to me taking any music out of that and using it?
No, you can use that.
Okay, thank you. I've got to sit down and listen to it again and know the music, but could you tell me a little bit about that while we're talking about it?
It was just one of the very first concerts I gave in New York. As I recall, it was quite nice. I was going to make a record of it at one time, but I got sidetracked.
Okay, well, I won't hold you up anymore. Thank you for the interview, and
Thank you.
I'll send this to you in about a week or two.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Goodbye.
Bye.